Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, the National Dialogue in Crisis with major foundations pulling out. The F.W. de Klerk Foundation explains its walkout. It's a lack of transparency at the heart of the dispute, it says. A new report highlighting untapped opportunities in South Africa's ICT sector and why the Minister's electricity review could still leave consumers paying more. It's Tuesday, the 12th of August. The cracks in South Africa's much-touted national dialogue are widening. Just days before the convention is set to begin, key players, including the F.W. de Klerk Foundation and the Thabo Mbeki Foundation, have pulled out. They've cited budgetary excesses, governance concerns, and a process they say has lost its way. Now, with a 700 million rand price tag and accusations that the agenda is being manipulated, questions are mounting over whether the dialogue can still deliver unity or if it is doomed at the very start. Sanusha Naidu from the Institute for Global Dialogue begins our coverage on the story, and we're going to discuss what's going wrong, what's at stake, and whether there is any path to a credible conversation. So, Sanusha, very warm welcome to you. Many say the dialogue has been rushed, undermining its legitimacy. From your vantage point, is meaningful citizen engagement still possible under the current constraints?
Good afternoon, Jeremy. Good afternoon to your listeners. It's quite difficult right now to see that meaningful context to be able to extrapolate it as a key factor, because already the whole dialogue has been enshrouded in all of these controversies and all of these questions around its credibility, its legitimacy, but also the question of those foundations that have pulled out. So the meaningful citizenship engagement becomes much more difficult to gauge and difficult to think how it will actually move forward, because now you're sitting with this cloud of controversy and this shadow over the national dialogue in terms of what's supposed to have been a very important discussion and interaction around how citizen participation and a participatory democracy can be further entrenched and moved and strengthened in terms of where our democracy is. So it becomes almost a sense of, I wouldn't say hopelessness, but a sense of cautionary issues, because it doesn't really give you the kind of confidence that this national dialogue will do what it was originally intended to do.
So it's going ahead nonetheless without these key participants that we've listed. What at the very least can it hope to achieve then?
Well, you know, the one thing is, let's not hope that this proceedings that will happen in terms of the national dialogue and the convention itself is going ahead. It's not going to just be an exercise in ticking a box. And I think that's the big challenge right now for the dialogue. The second thing I think is maybe perhaps to use the occasion to try and address some of these issues, because some of the issues that have been plaguing the national dialogue needs to be addressed before they can even start having any kind of meaningful interaction and significant engagement. But again, you know, for me, I think the gatekeeping on both sides, whether it's on the government side, whether it's on the civil society side, needs to be tackled head on. There needs to be an honest engagement, an honest discussion. And the question should be asked is, what is the value proposition and utility of the national dialogue in the current atmosphere we find ourselves in, where stakeholders are not necessarily at the table? Some stakeholders are probably looking at how they may tap into the resources. That's the financial tag that that they may get in terms of how this is being managed through the national, through NEDLAC. And more importantly, I think, you know, the challenge right now is, again, perhaps there needs to be more clarity about what this first meeting of the dialogue will look like, given that there are all of these issues that are basically circumventing and circling around the national dialogue.
Difficult, of course, at the 11th hour to reframe or redesign a new value proposition.
Absolutely. And perhaps, you know, the other thing that perhaps needs to be also mentioned as part of this is, do you want to have a national dialogue while you're also busy with the G20? Because to a large extent, the G20 presidency of South Africa covers part of what the discussion is around the issues with respect to the national dialogue around solidarity, equality and inclusivity and sustainability and all of that, and also some of the issues that South Africa has been ventilating as chair of the G20. And I think sometimes, you know, trying to engage in too many fronts, the multitasking may actually be a bit more difficult than that. So, you know, how much would it have taken to have just said, let's wait till after the G20 and we can really give our utmost, our attention and deal with all of these issues in terms of ensuring that we have this discussion? Because at the end of the day, I think there are too many competing agendas as well in the room.
So I'm hearing you say that a postponement is probably the best route to credibility.
I think it's a first step to credibility because it gives you the sense of basically taking time out to breathe, just to enable to assess where you are, what you are doing, and think about this value proposition that we're discussing. Because it may be that rushing into it right now may actually, you know, it feeds into the discourse of what is the narrative around the national dialogue, where some have argued that it's not, that its utility has no value proposition because it seems to be just an exercise in something that you need to get, you need to tick a box on. And so I think the question is, take a step back and ask yourself, you know, no money, if any money has been committed, if any money has been put down, I think if you're following the Treasury rules around how these allocations take place, you can actually, you know, place it in a kind of moratorium and say, we're going to wait until. So that for me makes it even more kind of gives you a sense of, you know, let's take a step back and see how we get to discuss this in a much more ventilated way. But what I feel now, there are a lot of egos in the room as well.
Sanusha, I'm reluctant to get into the weeds of procedural mechanics, but the Thabo Mbeki Foundation, in fact, other foundations too, citing violations, and I quote, of core dialogue principles. What's your understanding of that? What institutional design flaws do you think might have led to the breakdown?
Like you, I'm also not 100% clear about that, so I don't know what an institutional design flaw looks like. I don't know whether it is about the process in terms of how it was ventilated. It would be nice if we're given a little bit more information about what these institutional design flaws are. Is it on who's managing the process? Is it about the fact that it seems to be about government led and not necessarily citizens participatory, you know, those kinds of dynamics. It also seems to link to, you know, are they not agreeing on certain things with regard to not just the institutional issue, but also the agenda of this. So I think, you know, for me, looking from the outside in like you, Jeremy, it's very difficult to speculate what these design flaws are. But I think what needs to be done is that if it needs to go ahead, and it has to go ahead, then don't rush into it right now. Take a step back and try and deal with those institutional design flaws.
Always appreciate the crisp insight and analysis. That's Dr. Sanusha Naidu from the Institute for Global Dialogue.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now let's continue with the story, and the F.W. de Klerk Foundation has become the latest in a string of prominent institutions to walk away from the dialogue. The withdrawal follows heated debate over the budget, something like 700 million rand, also limited transparency in planning, and what some are seeing as a sidelining of key voices in shaping South Africa's future. It's a setback for a process that has been built previously as a platform to unite the nation around pressing economic, political and social challenges. Well, I want to talk now to Ishmael Yusup, who is the Foundation's Manager of Constitutional Advancement. Ishmael, a very warm welcome to you. If I've read this correctly, the Foundation citing a lack of transparency over the budget. Are there any other specific red flags that have prompted your withdrawal from the process?
Yes, there definitely is. Well, I just want to be clear. We, the FWSF Foundation, withdrew reluctantly, and we are not abandoning the national dialogue itself. What we've done is we've pulled out only from the preparatory task team and the initial convention on the 15th of August, not from the national dialogue. That's 13,500 dialogues, three ward-level dialogues per ward that will unfold afterwards. And why did we do this? We did it because certain core principles were being compromised by the rush to hold this convention. We believed always that this national convention and thereafter the dialogue should be citizen-led, inclusive, and bottoms-up. Now, something went wrong along the way, and what are those red flags that you're referring to? Well, the clearest example was the insistence on holding a convention despite warnings that we were not ready. We and other civil society partners went to the president and urged a short postponement because key groundwork, logistics, public outreach, community preparation wasn't being done. But even so, government officials pushed ahead, and that put a political timeline above the process's integrity. You know, in a civil society effort, if civil society says we need more time, you listen. But then there was the issue of transparency. We didn't get a clear budget or a clear operational plan until the 11th hour. When NEDLAC signed on to be the secretariat, they received their funds just last week. And so therefore, we, the foundations, lost confidence that the convention could be well organized or could be accountable under those circumstances. Decisions were coming from the top down. Processes were rushed and opaque. And that's exactly what we wanted to avoid and why we withdrew.
There is, of course, a flip side to the argument, is that the conversation needs to get started sooner rather than later, given the parlous position that the country finds itself in right now.
That's true. And I want to say this. We want the dialogue to move forward, but we want the dialogue to move forward on a solid footing. This isn't just about any group dictating terms. It's about making sure that the process actually works. I understand that there are concerns about delays. None of us want the dialogue to stall forever. Our fear was that launching in chaos would do much more harm to the dialogue process itself than to have a short 2-month delay. If the first impression to the public is a poorly organized talk shop, then you lose buy-in. The 900 civil society organizations who've signed up to contribute in kind to the dialogue will lose confidence in the process. Then your momentum is lost. So by pausing now, what we are doing as the foundations are actually protecting the dialogue's momentum in the long run, and we are absolutely not trying to derail anything.
What do you think the impact of your withdrawal and that of other foundations is going to be?
Well, it must be said that we, the F.W. de Klerk Foundation, as well as the six other legacy foundations who've pulled out, lent a hand of moral credibility to the process. That, yes, damages the reputation of the First National Convention, but I think speaks volumes that we will not lend our names to something that we think isn't done properly. You mentioned the budget, and I want to be clear that the core issue was not the budget. The core issue was proper planning, proper logistics. If we, the foundation, to represent large constituencies in civil society, see that there's a lack of proper planning, that there are various logistical issues, then yes, it speaks volumes to the process itself being rushed, hastened, and purely a political PR exercise.
It's still a pretty hefty price tag, though, isn't it?
You know, I want to be very clear on this. The 700 million rand was a concern, but not in the way that it's been portrayed. The 700 million rand was just a preliminary estimate for the entire dialogue process, the potentially thousands of community meetings over many months, not the cost of a 2-day event. And in fact, I was part of drafting a number of budgets. There was a budget that was between 20 to 30 million rand. The 700 million rand, therefore, was an estimate, and we will not know the true figure of the budget because it's a dynamic budget. And I mentioned the 900 civil society organizations who've contributed in kind. That was during my tenure as co-chairperson of public mobilization. That's meant to reduce the costs dramatically. So in reality, we expect the actual spending to be far less. And we've always pushed to keep the budget lean, to involve private sector support so that taxpayers wouldn't shoulder everything. But our stance isn't about demanding a specific rand amount. It's about saying plan whatever budget you have carefully and transparently before you execute. If that isn't happening, we cannot lend our arms to the convention.
You talk about a lack of moral credibility post the withdrawal of these organizations. Is there a subtext here that this process, without your involvement and others, is potentially dead in the water?
No, the national dialogue, as we've seen from the press conference yesterday, will continue. But I do think that there must be a way to get the foundations back onto the table. And I must say this to the South African people, that we are ready to engage as soon as the process is realigned with those core principles that we agreed on. That means a credible plan for broad-based community involvement, transparent management so that people can trust what's happening. If we see that, you find us back at the table, actively participating. So to the South Africans who are skeptical about the process right now, I would say we understand your skepticism, but don't write off the national dialogue. Our very reason for raising these issues is to make sure that this dialogue is something that we can believe in, and we don't withdraw to sabotage. We do this to insist that the process be genuine and not just a token exercise. So not dead in the water, but desperately in need of realignment with the core principles.
Explain to me what you mean by a lack of transparent management.
Well, what I say is this. When I refer to a lack of transparency, you must realize that the foundations that began on this road as far as 15 months ago with the Thabo Mbeki Foundation making the call for a national dialogue, thereafter we engaged with a group of 50 civil society organizations in September and were given the green light to form something called a PrepCom, a preparatory committee consisting just of the legacy foundations, who also served as chairpersons of the various working committees. Everything was transparent up to that point. Problems really started when that PrepCom became a larger preparatory task team, now a tripartite alliance with government and with NEDLAC. But the lack of transparency that I'm referring to is this. Resources were promised to us by government. We hadn't seen resources up until the 5th of August last week that were transferred to NEDLAC. There were certain key decisions on the venue being procured, on procurement processes that we believe flouted the PFMA, that we as the foundations were kept completely in the dark of. And this is the lack of transparency that I'm managing. As the accountable partners to the dialogue process, we would have preferred to have been kept abreast with all of these developments so that we can play an active role in the convention and the dialogue, but also to keep our constituencies aware of what's happening. There's also been a great lack of communication amongst ourselves, but amongst us as the PTT and society in general. I think society isn't fully aware of what is going on with the convention and therefore not fully bought into the dialogue process itself.
I need a very quick answer to this because time is against us. Are we losing sight of the broad intention because of concerns over procedure?
I think when we look at the national dialogue, there must be a realization that if we don't talk, we are going to fight. And I think even government realizes that. I just wish that we all get on board, all hands on deck, to make sure that the process runs off as it was intended. If we do not do that, then the dialogue we lose as our last best hope to save South Africa from the abyss.
Ishmael Yusuf from the F.W. de Klerk Foundation, thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, I don't need to tell you that South Africa's ICT sector is growing, and it's growing fast. And there's a fascinating new report out from the Collective X. It points to what is termed zones of opportunity for young job seekers. What am I talking about? Well, I guess anything from artificial intelligence to data analytics, cybersecurity, and e-commerce. But are we doing enough to prepare young people to seize these roles with a degree of alacrity? And how can we ultimately turn potential into paychecks? So let's deep dive into this a little with Rob Urquhart, who is Executive for Impacted Learning at the Collective X. So Rob, not surprisingly, your report forecasts major ICT job growth. I get that. But how big is the boom in South Africa right now?
We think it's fairly significant. Despite what the data from the Quarterly Labour Force Survey tells us, that we've seen drops in the number of jobs in the sector over the last couple of years, sort of post-pandemic, it still remains for us a sunrise sector with a lot of scope of growth. I think globally, the growth forecasts are around 19%, if I'm not mistaken. You know, we're bullish about the prospects. Despite seeing sector declines, we think that it's still a sector with tremendous opportunity. You know, given the disruption and the rate of change, I think it's an incredibly dynamic and exciting sector to be working in for young people.
So let's focus on this phrase, zones of opportunity. What stands out then as the fastest growing and most accessible?
That's a great question, because we've got to look at that in two ways. I think we've got to look at what the historic labor market data is telling us, which is that jobs like software developers, web developers, business analysts, data analysts are all spaces where there have been a large number of opportunities and relatively fewer applications when we've looked at our data set. And so those certainly represent, sort of, from a scope perspective, Jeremy, opportunities that are, you know, where there's a number of opportunities and relatively fewer applications, and good opportunities to try and move into. What we have seen, which is interesting in the data, is something slightly different, is we've seen that there are perhaps a smaller number of jobs that are more absorptive of young people. I must acknowledge that there are smaller sample sizes, but if we look at jobs such as artificial intelligence and machine learning developers, data scientists, even cloud developers, when we looked at the percentage of those jobs that were suitable for early career entrants, we find that that percentage is quite high. So seemingly indicating that there's a willingness to hire more into these job opportunities at the entry level. And, you know, our hypothesis around this is potentially that these are jobs that are in high demand in general and command a high salary and command premiums when you're searching in the labor market. And so firms may be more willing to take on younger people into these opportunities and train them up rather than trying to pay premiums. Particularly if you're an SME, this might be the zones where you want to kind of look at.
More willing, I absolutely accept that, but I'd also suggest to you that there is a fairly big gap between speed of demand and what the education system is currently delivering in that respect. There must be a deficit, surely.
There is absolutely, absolutely a deficit, and you know, often that criticism is leveraged at the TVET system, but I think that applies to the public university systems as well. I also think we're in a space where the market, and certainly in conversations with employers and training providers last week, there isn't a huge amount of certainty right now about exactly what these skills look like. So we see employers trying to figure out how they use some of these new technologies and what they mean for their businesses. And I don't think are fully able yet to articulate what that looks like in a very clear view from a skill which they can communicate to the training sector to produce. So on the one hand, we have, you know, this inability to state what is needed. On the other, we have education systems that aren't producing graduates at the rate that they should. And although not referenced in that research, when I had a look at the sort of throughput rates from universities, TVETs, public and private higher education institutions, overall, we have a throughput rate in South Africa of about 24%. So we've got a two-pronged problem. One, we've got a sort of lag in the information about what is needed. On the second, we aren't getting young people through the education systems in the numbers that we need and in the volumes that we need.
Rob, test my thinking on this theory. I'm wondering, as I listen to you, whether there is potentially a parity problem here. And what I'm saying is, how do we ensure that growth in the ICT sector doesn't just benefit the already skilled and connected without widening inequality?
Yeah, I mean, this is a massively important question. And it's something that I worry about is this doubling down on a digital divide. How do you exclude young people or people, for matter of fact, who don't have access to either education or necessarily the technology to be able to do that? It's a real concern that I think we have to have a watch list on it as a country. The glass half full part of me would like to believe that there are potentially opportunities to leapfrog some of these moments. I was chatting to the founder of Grassroots AI last week, and she reminded me that on all our cell phones, everyone pretty much uses WhatsApp. Embedded in WhatsApp actually is AI. You open WhatsApp and you'll see at the top of your WhatsApp. And so in many senses, AI is very accessible, but that is obviously hindered by accessibility to broad, you know, accessibility to Wi-Fi, costs, or mobile costs, and so on. Mm. So I don't have a direct answer for you. I think it's a real risk. Mm. But I would also like to believe that there is opportunity. These moments represent opportunities to leapfrog the requirements of long degree processes.
Right.
I do think that the rate of growth that we're seeing is going to require investments and skilling that are far more short-term, far more agile, and far more outcomes-focused. I think investing in a four-year education degree that's very focused on a particular aspect at the moment is quite limited.
And I'm going to say, accompanied by the familiar soundtrack of a barking dog and Hardy Dars,
is
Rob Urquhart, Executive for Impact and Learning at the Collective X. Rob, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, I don't need to tell you that electricity prices are climbing, and even a ministerial review is not going to stop the pain, particularly for big business. With new charges like the generation fee and legacy charge in play, companies, I imagine, are scrambling to rein in costs. So the question is, how do they stay one step ahead? Someone who might have some answers to that is Brandon Horn from Solar Africa. So Brandon, a very warm welcome. The minister, Kgosietso Ramakgopa, has promised relief. But do you think that's going to make any real big difference for business?
Morning, Jeremy. Yeah, and thanks for the opportunity. I believe this topic today is a burning point in most business owners' minds. Firstly, it's a step in the right direction. Acknowledging the electricity costs are becoming unaffordable, or as the minister puts it, addressing these rising electricity costs before it leads to energy poverty. In reality, though, we might see some form of short-term relief, but there are many underlying issues that are both complex and uncertain. Just take a look at what South Africans went through during load shedding, and have we even fixed that problem? If we see any form of relief, it's probably going to be for lower income households. Whereas for larger users of electricity, I think we're going to still see a cost that is escalating and remains high, in my opinion.
Are you able, Brandon, to just give me a sense of the new fees that businesses are then facing and why they are so significant?
Yes, definitely. So the generation capacity and legacy charges have been introduced to improve cost recovery and transparency, according to Eskom. Okay, they're designed to ensure all customers contribute fairly to grid infrastructure and maintenance, regardless of how much energy they consume. Let's maybe unpack this a little bit more on the actual charges themselves. So what is a generation capacity charge? It's meant to ensure that all customers, including those with embedded generation, and embedded generation is your rooftop solar, carport, ground mount, etc., contribute to the cost of maintaining the electrical grid capacity. Okay, it's a rand per kVA based utilized capacity charge that's indicated on your Eskom bill. The rationale kind of behind it is it's meant to address a situation where customers with their own generation, okay, so this is where you're generating your own power behind the meter, okay, may use grid primarily as a backup. So during the day, you're utilizing your solar production, and then you move on to outside of daylight hours, the grid as a backup. This results in lowering energy charges that don't cover the fixed cost of maintaining the grid. Whereas with the legacy charge, okay, this is meant to recover costs associated with Eskom's legacy contracts with independent power producers, so IPPs, during the REAP program. These IPPs sell electricity directly through to Eskom through renewable sources such as wind, hydro, biogas, landfill gas, and solar. And it's a separate charge on your bill that's in a cents per kilowatt hour that factors into the overall energy cost. It sounds a bit dubious because what you're seeing here is these charges are meant to ensure that the cost of these long-term contracts that Eskom entered into, that at the time were unaffordable. Now the end consumer has to pay for that unaffordability in that contract that's now being passed through. Eskom signed it. The consumer now has to pay for it down the line.
I guess begs the next question. With the costs so volatile then, as you've outlined to me, it's going to become that much more difficult, I imagine, for companies to plan their energy budgets.
Yeah, definitely. Many companies have already taken the first step, okay, by producing their own electricity through an on-site solar solution, either buying it as an outright purchase or through a CapEx-free power purchase agreement. This would have given them roughly, call it anything from 15 to 30% savings on the utility bill. There are also other options of which we refer to as a time of use battery. The concept being that you can charge the battery during cheaper times of electricity supply, or charge the battery from on-site solar and then discharge the battery with the cheap electricity at peak periods when your electricity is the most expensive. These options, you will have less of an impact on the tariff increases and additional charges. If Eskom then decide to change the time of use period, as they've just done recently, you simply adjust your charging and discharging times for your battery accordingly to mitigate this these risks.
There is the argument, and I'm sure you'll have a counterpoint, that solar and battery solutions are still too expensive. Or have we moved past that perception?
So I think we saw, if you can call it a gold rush, that was, so to speak, superficially imposed in South Africa as a result of load shedding. The global demand of solar panels has, the cost of the panels have come down, battery prices have come down significantly. So if we look at 7 years ago versus today, your costs have reduced significantly on the actual cost of solar equipment, which makes it even more affordable nowadays for the end consumer to kind of take over their own control of electricity by putting a solution on site for the reduction in costs if you compare it to Eskom or your utility.
Brandon, from a risk perspective, how exposed are businesses at the moment to future tariff shocks if they don't act now?
Yeah, I think you make a good point. And I think if we look at a layered in approach, okay, and what we refer to as an energy stacking approach, it's part of our Electricity 2.0 product, okay? We understand that clients are on different stages of electricity usage or life cycle. And as a result of that, we offer a stackable solution that caters to their needs today. But as their business grows, so too will their electricity requirements. So we start off with analyzing the client's bill. We then have a good understanding of how they use power, and then we start overlaying it, okay, with a product. Normally, we look at an on-site solution first and foremost. So we look at a solar solution, behind-the-meter solution, and then we factor in the next layer being a time-of-use battery that we mentioned before, and we overlay that once again with another product called Wheeling. This stackable product offers a cost reduction with each layered approach. And finally, we look at electricity trading that combines multiple sources of renewable energy production to provide the final layer into the client's load profile and takes them anything up to 70 to 90% renewable through one invoice to the client on a monthly basis. This allowing clients to plan more effectively, okay, with regards to their electricity costs. And ultimately, we know anytime that there's an electricity tariff or increase, et cetera, this goes directly into the cost of the product they're manufacturing, which ultimately the consumer has to pay for.
To the layman, that might sound complicated, though. Do you think there is still a gap in understanding or even urgency from corporate South Africa in that respect?
Most definitely. And I think what we've seen in the industry is most companies, they're very good in their core business. And when they're then looking for a renewable energy product to assist them in either reducing carbon emissions or cost of electricity, they've actually started to either employ a dedicated resource within their business, or they've gone out externally to an expert in the industry. I think businesses understand the cost of electricity and also understand that we need to be on this journey going renewable. And as a result of that, have kind of taken the next step by either employing their own resource internally or going to speak to experts.
Well, there's no doubt the paradigm has completely shifted in the last 18 months to 2 years. From Solar Africa, Brandon Horn, thank you very much indeed for talking to me. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.